From the Rocky Horror Picture Show to Monty Python and the Holy Grail to Eraserhead, cult films, like vampires, seem to live forever. But just what is a cult film, and how do they develop the dedicated fan base that keeps them going? Which ones deserve to live in our memories and up on the big screen? On the next Central Standard, we'll review the latest movies at your local Cineplex, plus we'll take a look at what it takes to become a cult film and chat about the local venues that showcase them. Do you have a favorite cult movie? We encourage you to join in on the conversation with me, Russ Simmons, and my fellow film critics on today's Central Standard. That's coming up right after this hour's news. And good morning, Kansas City, and welcome to Central Standard. I'm Russ Simmons, sitting in the host chair today, which obviously means it's movie day. And I'm joined by my fellow film critics to chat about movies that have opened over the last month or so. And also, we'll be talking about cult movies, things like Rocky Horror Picture Show, Eraserhead, some of the other great all-time cult movies. And we'd like you to join in on the conversation. What is a cult movie that you've loved or hated? What have you taken part in as far as participation in cult movie events? We want to hear from you, so give us a call at 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCURCST, or obviously you can also join in on the conversation on our Facebook page. So we'll be talking about contemporary movies and cult movies today, and in the second half of our show, we'll be joined by Ryan Davis, the creative director at the Alamo Drafthouse, which specializes in cult movie showcases. Once again, I'm Russ Simmons with Fox 4 and KKFI FM, and today I'm joined by...
This is Loie Lockerbie. I freelance for the Kansas City Star. I have a blog at suchacritic.com and write DVD reviews for kcactive.com.
And Tom Poe, and I'm film professor at UMKC.
Tom, if I could impose on your good nature for a moment, before we jump into talking about the contemporary films, as I said, we're going to be talking about cult movies. So would you be kind enough in your role as professor, as the academic on the panel here today, to tell us just what is a cult film?
You know, sometimes the best academics have to tell the truth and say, oh, boy, no one can seem to agree on a definition of what is a true cult film. Oh, the way I approach it is that, in fact, what we have to kind of do is have categories so that we kind of at least define what, in any given discussion, we're talking about when we use that term cult film. Oh, some cult films are those that can be described as so bad that they are good, or at least awfully a lot of fun. So anything by Ed Wood, for example, would fall into that category. Oh, or films like Attack of the Killer Tomatoes or The Lepus. Oh, a lot of sci-fi could fit into that category. Oh, and then there's a second category that I would say are quality cult films. Those are films that didn't get any notice at one time, but over the years have developed very loyal sort of admirers. Oh, something like Todd Browning's Freaks, I think, would be an example of a quality cult film. Oh, the little cheap film noir Detour, which we teach now in our film history classes, that no one when that film came out could imagine that in 2014 college students would be required to study Detour. Samuel Fuller's Shock Corridor, Donnie Darko would be examples of that. And then there's the third category I think I call camp cult. Camp cult, in fact, is sort of films which have a real life because they form communities. Oh, and so the fun tends to be kind of you're a part of a particular group of people that these films are meaningful to. Oh, so camp cult would be films like Glenn or Glinda. Oh, maybe Mommy Dearest.
Oh. Yeah.
And most particularly Rocky Horror. I expect we'll be talking about all of those. The other last comment I'll make, because I think this is something that's interesting to argue about. Can a film that is made to be a cult film be truly a cult film? So a movie like Attack of the Killer Tomatoes tries to be instant cult. And so we can argue and discuss that and hope some callers might come in and give their opinions about.
Please put on your thinking caps out there, and we want to hear from you. So if you have a favorite cult film or if you have a question about cult films, give us a call at 816-235-2888. But first of all, we're going to start talking about the films that have opened up over the last month or so in the Kansas City metro. And one is, I don't know, maybe a potential cult film of the future. It's a film based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning play by Tracy Letts, and it's called August, Osage County.
Well, I guess it works on stage. Tom can speak to this because he's an aficionado of the play. On film, not so much. It's set in rural Oklahoma, where a writer played by Sam Shepard has disappeared, and his extremely dysfunctional wife, played by Meryl Streep, who is addicted to pills and alcohol and dying of cancer, and you name it, it's piled on here. She gathers the family together, in-laws, her kids, granddaughter, and it basically just turns into this festival of screeching and recrimination and picking on each other and sexual peccadillos, and it's just, it's loud, it's shrill, it's irritating, the dialogue, nobody talks like that. And I think the problem fundamentally is that you can play to the cheap seats in the theater, but on film it's much more intimate. You have to tone it down a little bit, and there is no toning down here. Everybody is devouring scenery the whole time.
Speaking of which, let's take a little listen to some of the dialogue from Tracy Letts' August, Osage County right now.
What'd you do to your hair?
I had it straightened.
Why would anybody do that?
Just wanted a change.
You're a pretty girl. Why don't you wear makeup?
Do I need makeup?
Every woman needs makeup. Don't let anybody tell you different. The only woman pretty enough to go without makeup was Elizabeth Taylor, and she wore a ton. Shoulders are all slumped and your hair's all straight. You don't wear makeup. You look like a lesbian.
Mom.
You could get a decent man if you would just spruce up a bit. That's all I'm saying. My tongue is on fire.
You supposed to be smoking?
Is anybody supposed to smoke?
That's the drug-addled matriarch of the family, Meryl Streep, chatting with her daughter, played by Julianne Nicholson. So what did you think about that dialogue, Loy?
You know, that's probably one of the better dialogue passages because it actually sounds like real people talking, but there's an awful lot of it that just sounds written, you know? And I think one of the best rules of writing is if it sounds like somebody sat down and wrote it, it's probably not going to work that well. And I've never in my life been embarrassed for Meryl Streep. I always think she's great no matter what. But, I mean, she's reduced to wandering around the house in this sort of drugged up daze going, this is my house, and slurred accent. Oh, my gosh. I really disliked this movie so intensely.
And out of 5 stars, how many would you give it?
1.
Okay. Tom?
I'm going to be slightly kinder, but not a whole lot. Oh, I have seen the play, and in fact, a very good production here at Kansas City Rep. And I do think that it works in a theater. One of the real problems with this movie, though, is that the play is very long, like 3 hours. And so they cut an hour out of the original Pulitzer Prize winning play to make the movie. What that means is they give you, in fact, sort of the most dramatic moments, which just come right on top of each other. So there's nothing subtle that is left, and that's one of the real structural problems with this screenplay, which was, in fact, written by Tracy Letts, so you can't blame someone else
right,
for that major problem. In live theater, you know, chewing up the scenery can be quite thrilling, because you've got this critical distance, and live theater is already artificial. But in a movie, by its very nature, movies are naturalistic, especially when, in fact, they're shot on location. And that's one of the real problems, I think, with this adaptation. Because I think on the screen, in this naturalistic setting, it's easier to see the play's faults. for all its awards, suddenly the play started feeling kind of like a retread of the dysfunctional family melodrama in the tradition of Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, Meryl Streep's Mama Could Be Big Daddy, or Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. The big difference is those are great plays which have lasted. But suddenly, watching the film version of August Osage County, it all started feeling a little bit silly. That said, I think the one person that acquits herself the best is Julia Roberts. And maybe it's just because her character, in fact, isn't given quite the look, Ma, I'm acting dialogue that Meryl Streep is forced to sort of recite. So I think that it ends up becoming a greatly reduced experience. So I don't know.
Well, out of 5 stars, how many do you think you give it, Tom?
I'm going to double low end, give it 2.5.
Ooh. Wow. Well, I guess I liked it a little bit better than both of you, even though I didn't really like it. So I guess it's damning with faint praise. I love the cast, and Margot Martindale in particular, I thought, and Kansas City's own Chris Cooper is terrific. And the moments that work in the film, but I thought overall it just seemed very overwrought to me. And I wound up, these characters are so irritating that I just didn't care. After a while, I just wanted to turn it off. So I'm going to give it a 3 for the cast, but I think between the three of us, we can give it a 2 out of 5, and obviously that's not doing very well for August Osage County rated R. We have a couple of people that wanted to chime in really quickly about cult films. As I said, we'll be chatting about those after the half-hour break, but we wanted to get Karen in on the conversation to tell us about a cult film that she particularly enjoyed. Hi, Karen.
Hi, good morning. How are you?
I'm well, thanks.
Good. The movie I wanted to tell you about is called Somewhere in Time. Mm-hmm. It was made in, I think, 1978 or 79, and it starred Christopher Reeve and Jane Seymour, and it takes place, the majority of it, at a hotel called the Grand Hotel in Mackinac Island. And when I walked out of the movie theater in 79, I said, at some point in my life, I'm going to go to that hotel because it's just magnificent.
Yes, it is.
And I had the opportunity in, I think it was like 1996, to go there. And little did I know, it's my birthday weekend. And I go there and I start seeing people dressed up in 1900s attire, which is the time period in which the movie took place. And apparently the hotel every weekend, I think it's in October every year, has a Somewhere in Time theme weekend. And the weekend I went, they had a few of the minor characters that appeared in the movie, but there was this big buzz going on, and eventually what happened is we found out Christopher Reeve, for the first time ever, was going to be there. Now, the other attendees were all part of a group called INSIGHT, which stands for International Group of Somewhere in Time Enthusiasts, or something like that.
Wow.
And the place just went crazy. They have a theater, and he came on stage and answered questions for about 2 hours, took a tour of the property with all of his fans, and it was particularly meaningful because that was about 6 months before his riding accident.
Oh, wow.
And so I had no idea. I thought I was maybe one of the two females in the world who just fell in love with this movie.
No, you were among a large number.
A very large number. It was just one of the most fun weekends I've had, you know, with people dressing up and quoting lines from the movie and everything.
It was a great experience. Thank you so much. What a great call. I appreciate your input.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. Well, I want to get Bob in as well to the conversation. Bob, who wanted to talk to us about a movie called Little Fugitive. Is that right, Bob?
That's correct.
Well, welcome aboard. What is Little Fugitive? I'm not familiar with it.
Little Fugitive is a picture that was filmed in the early 1950s. It's about two brothers who are left at home over the weekend because their mother has to go out of town to care for her sister or for her mother. And this all takes place in Brooklyn. The older boy is maybe about 11 or 12. The younger brother, probably 7. Amateur actors were selected for this. Cinema Verity, a much simpler time. The whole bit about the younger brother trying to keep up with the older brother and being somewhat of a pest with his friends, and they play a little prank on the little brother, making him believe that he's shot his older brother with a BB gun and has killed him.
It's, Bob, what would you say is the quality of this film that, in your mind, makes it a cult movie?
It's the fact that it hasn't been seen that much,
okay,
except in the Northeast, and it is so true to childhood that this boy, the little boy, goes and takes the subway down. He's run away from home because he shot his brother. He goes to Coney Island. I mean, a wonderland, a place of amazement, all the joys of childhood from going to an amusement park.
Hey, thanks so much, Bob. Really appreciate it. Sounds like an interesting movie, and I'm going to seek that one out.
Okay, thank you very much.
Appreciate your call.
Bye-bye.
Let's move on and talk about another potential cult film of the future. It's one that stars Mark Wahlberg. It's a action and war film called Lone Survivor. Tom?
Yes, this is a war film, in some ways in the tradition of World War II, John Wayne war films, with lots of sort of macho patriotic sort of fervor, all the way up to the much more recent Black Hawk Down. It's directed by Peter Berg, the creator of Friday Night Lights, who has sort of a knack for male melodrama, what sometimes I call the male weeper, because in Hollywood, melodramas were oftentimes called, women's films were called women's weepers. It's based on the best-selling biography by Navy SEAL Marcus Luttrell, and has a really good cast, headlined by Mark Wahlberg, who's really becoming a remarkable actor, and includes Emile Hirsch and Taylor Kitsch and Ben Foster. I haven't read the book, but from what I understand, it's pretty politically jingoistic. And for me, the movie begins with that feeling. But once the action begins, it becomes so emotionally compelling, almost overpoweringly compelling. It's a hard film to watch. I give you some forewarning about that.
Yeah.
And at the same time, what I really appreciated is that it becomes more politically nuanced. Character development may be in short supply, but boy, I sure found it a powerful emotional experience that raised some important ethical questions about the war in Afghanistan. So by the end of the film, I was really won over, and I feel comfortable giving it 3.5 stars.
Just want to remind you, you're listening to Central Standard here on KCUR, and you can join in on the conversation by calling us at 816-235-2888. Or tweet us at KCURCST. Lori, what was your reaction to Lone Survivor?
I think Tom makes a good point in that it improves as it goes along. It's obviously intended as a tribute to the men who died during this mission, and it's very effective in that way. But it's when you just have these four guys in the hills outside this village in Afghanistan struggling to survive. That's when the intensity really kicks in. And Berg knows how to direct an action scene without giving you a migraine.
Right.
And the performances are absolutely first rate. And the tension, I mean, you know what's going to happen. It's like, you know, in Titanic, you know the boat's going to sink. It's how you get there that's
right.
Interesting. And in this case, Lone Survivor, but it's getting to that point and seeing the interaction and realizing just how much – like one thing going wrong or one decision that doesn't quite work can have a domino effect. In this case, they're sent to a location that's supposed to be a great lookout point over this village, but it's not, and they have to move. And that maneuver creates the conditions that leads to all of these other things happening.
Right.
And it really, you feel that that high wire tension of what these guys are doing out there. So, yeah, I think three. Would you give it 3.5?
Yeah, I gave it 3.5.
I think that's fair, 3.5.
Yeah, you know, the thing that I was most impressed by was the fact that it really did put you into the soldier's boots. I mean, you really felt like you were there under fire. And which is the strength of the movie. But there's one scene in it that kind of elevated it a bit more, and that's the discussion that the soldiers are having is how to handle this situation, because it was really interesting and it really brought up some ethical points that could be good coffee talk fodder for after the movie.
And apparently it never happened.
Oh, is that?
Yeah, I was reading an article with Luttrell, and he said that, you know, they didn't have that debate. It was inserted more for dramatic effect in the movie, but that there was no debate. They knew what they were going to do.
Well, that debate did work on film.
Yeah.
Well, that goes to, I think, one of the interesting things is that Peter Berg and the filmmakers set out, I think, to make a more nuanced film than the book, where I think he would have no qualms at all about there being ethical issues involved.
Well,
Luttrell
approved of it. Yeah,
yes.
I mean, he approved it for cinematic reasons, but he was pretty intimately involved in the making of the films.
So. Mm-hmm. I'm going to give it 3.5 stars as well. I think that it's a very solid action film if you take it only on that level. Now, I don't know if it's got a point of view, which is maybe a bit of a drawback. I know, Tom, you were saying that you thought that you'd heard that the book was a little jingoistic, and maybe they tried to pull back from that, but It's as an action film, it does work. Before we move on, I did want to quickly bring in Anna into the conversation because Anna wants to take us to task for our review of August OCH County. So, Anna, what's your opinion?
I absolutely love the movie. I don't think the critics understand dysfunction. I have family that is that crazy, and I think they are so off target on this real-life, gritty, gross, true drama.
There you go. You know what? I have a fellow critic who I had this very discussion with, and she is actually a counselor. And she had exactly the same reaction as you, saying, yeah, I've heard this dialogue from the people that I've worked with.
I absolutely loved it. Right down to eat the fish. Eat the effing fish.
I hear you. Hey, Anna, thank you so much for your input. We appreciate it.
Good show. Great show.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.
All right, let's quickly talk about another film that I do think has the real potential of being a cult film. It's called Her. It's a sci-fi romance from Spike Jones, and we're going to listen really quickly to a clip from Her.
What about you, Theodore? What do you love most about Samantha?
Oh, God. She's so many things. I guess that's what I love most about her. You know, she isn't just one thing. She's so much larger than that.
Oh, thanks, Theodore.
See, Samantha, he is so much more evolved than I am.
You know what's interesting? I used to be so worried about not having a body, but now I truly love it. You know, I'm growing in a way that I couldn't if I had a physical form. I mean, I'm not limited. I can be anywhere and everywhere simultaneously. I'm not tethered to time and space in a way that I would be if I was stuck in a body that's inevitably going to die.
Yikes.
No. No. I didn't mean it like that. I just meant that it was a different experience.
No. Samantha, we know exactly what you mean. We're all dumb humans.
No.
No.
Sorry.
That was the voice of Scarlett Johansson as an artificially intelligent operating system that Joaquin Phoenix falls in love with in a futuristic sci-fi melodrama slash romance called Her from writer-director Spike Jones. And this guy has got to be perhaps the smartest director working in film today. What an interesting and twisted outlook that this gentleman has. But this is a film that I think a lot of people like and a lot of people dislike for the same reasons. But I just think that in this case, Joaquin Phoenix, his character is a little bit too wishy-washy. That's my only real criticism of this film, because I thought it was brilliantly written, smartly executed, funny, and it does raise some very interesting questions about the future. But overall, I'm going to give it a 3.5 out of 5. Loie?
This is one of my favorite movies from this year. I think it's extremely smart It does bring up interesting questions about how technology is progressing and how we relate to it and the degree to which, you know, if a machine becomes sentient, does it become kind of its own species? Does it have its own, you know, voice, not just a disembodied voice, but a sense of itself? It's very romantic in a strange, funny way. and it really, I think the details of what the near future could look like and feel like are very, very carefully constructed. Spike Jonze is probably the ultimate cult director in many ways because his movies are just weird enough that they don't appeal to large groups of the population. But people who do love his movies really love his movies.
But perhaps they... very definition of a cult.
Yeah, I think it is. You know, it's something that doesn't necessarily have big mainstream appeal, but it has followers and they are very devoted. But this is, I mean, it got Oscar nomination for Best Picture. It's definitely doing better than most cult films do in this regard. But that's because it's a very sensitive and very intelligent movie. And I think it's something you can watch multiple times and probably get something new out of it each time.
True.
So I'm going to give it a 5. It's one of my top
Excellent.
Ones this year.
And Tom?
I really loved this movie, and so I agree with everything that's been said. Indeed, I think it follows this trajectory of futuristic films going back to HAL in 2001, to Blade Runner, to Kubrick Spielberg's AI, where computer-generated characters are more human, perhaps, than the humans. And that's what is so sort of fascinating, I think, about Spike Jonze's movie. You know, he's made things like Being John Malkovich, an adaptation, and Where the Wild Things Are. And when I can say that this film may be his best, that's really saying something. I will say that maybe I identified with Phoenix's character a bit more than Russ did, because I'm more that nerdy, emotionally isolated guy that tends to have more dates online than ever in real life.
Were you also sitting there thinking, you know, dating an operating system might not be so bad?
Well, I was sitting there thinking I probably have dated. sort of.
Some artificial intelligence out there?
Right, right. So in fact, all three of us are members of the Kansas City Film Critics Circle. Lois, our president, and we had the recent vote, and I ended up voting for 12 Years a Slave as the best picture, but I thought a lot about it, and I could have easily voted for her. And I think that they're a good match because the two most important films of 2013 were 12 Years a Slave, that makes us face our past, and Her, that makes us face our future. So I'm going to give it 4.5.
All right. So between a 3.5, a 5, and a 4.5, let's go ahead and say 4.5 for Her. That's rated R. We're going to be talking about cult films when we come back from the break, as well as covering some of the other films that have opened up over the last month or so. We'll be joined by Ryan Davis, the creative director at the Alamo Drafthouse. We'll be right back. Yes, all the critics are dancing around the table doing the time warp. Lori, sit down. Sit down. We've got to get back to the microphone.
Get off the desk. Sorry.
That, of course, is a clip from the Rocky Horror Picture Show, maybe the ultimate cult film, one that continues to have a life well, well beyond what anyone ever dreamed it would have back in the 70s when it was first released. We're joined by Ryan Davis from the Alamo Drafthouse. He's the creative director who is responsible for a lot of the special cult programming that they do that really is the hallmark of the Alamo Drafthouse. Welcome, Ryan.
Well, thank you for having me on.
Sure.
We'll actually be playing the Rocky Horror Picture Show at the end of the month.
There you go.
Yeah.
It continues to live.
We're not surprised. Yeah.
Shock.
We have a few quick announcements we need to make before we get back into the conversation. And something that we'll be talking about shortly are the 2014 Oscar Short Film Showcases. They actually opened today, and this is going to be at the Tivoli. And thanks once again to Jerry Harrington for making these available. These are the three different programs. Actually, I believe there's two opening today. One is the animated program. One is the live action program. And the other is the documentary shorts, which I understand are opening later on. There are three different admissions for those, but you get a chance to see the Oscar-nominated short films. Also at the Tivoli, we have some National Theater Live productions. Rory Kinnear in Hamlet, which is January 26th. I guess we missed that one. Tom Hiddleston in Shakespeare's Coriolanus. I know that Lori would like that one. Saturday, February 15th at 11 a.m. And the UMKC School of Communication Studies, which our pal Tom Poe heads up there, is going to be having a series at the Tivoli called Movies About Making Movies. Tom?
Yes, these are both narrative films and also documentaries about the process of making films, and they're going to be on Thursday evenings at 7 p.m. At least some of the Thursdays in February 6 is one. That's going to be Werner Herzog's a documentary about everything it took to make Fitzcarraldo. And then, very excitingly, on March 6, Jean-Luc Godard's Contempt. And it's going to be particularly interesting to a lot of folks in Kansas City. It's going to be sort of the first trying out of the Tivoli Theater's new digital system. And we're going to have Day of the Locust and The Five Obstructions, which is also a documentary, this one about Lars von Trier's sort of insane way of approaching movie making. So anyway, check the Tivoli's website to get all the complete information.
And you can also find that information at kcur.org. And also, the Fine Arts Group is presenting their Gather Preview Series at the Glenwood Arts, which is a continuing opportunity to see independent films that have not yet been released. So you can kind of like have the Sundance experience at the Glenwood Arts. And these are Thursdays. And February at 7:30, there are a number of different independent films. So you can find out more information at kcur.org. And also the Europe and Holocaust films at the Leawood Theater. These are classic films dealing with the subject of the Holocaust, and the first film would be The Garden of the Finzi Continis, March 4th at 7 p.m. That's Vittoria De Sica's 1970 classic, again at the Leawood. And the Screenland Group and Downright Creepy present this year's Panic Fest, a collection of horror, thriller, and sci-fi films, as well as horror games and special events. These are taking place at the Screenland Armor starting tonight, January 31st through February 2nd, and more information on the events page at KCUR. Tom?
And I have one other very special invitation to everyone. During February, the UMKC Museum of Art is doing a very special sort of program titled Redefining Marriage in the 21st Century. And it's going to be accompanied not only by the art displays, but then a number of academic presentations. But in the midst of all of that, we're going to be doing a special screening on February 13th in recognition of Valentine's Day Eve of the documentary Bridegroom that was made by Linda Bloodworth Thomason, who created Designing Women. And in fact, it's the documentary about sort of the ill-fated, tragic love of two men. So it's a documentary which leads into that whole discussion about redefining marriage. That's going to be February 13th at the Tivoli Theater. It's going to start at 5:30 p.m., and I'm going to be introducing the evening and the film. So it's free, so please feel invited.
And today we're exploring cult films, and we want to hear from you. What are your favorite cult films? What changes an absurd or awful film into something that becomes an enduring cult classic? Join the conversation by calling us at 816-235-2888 or tweet us at KCURCST, or you can join in on the conversation on KCUR's Facebook page. We've had a number of people that have been contacting us. Bar on Twitter tweeted us, nothing tops Vincent Gallo and Buffalo 66 for the ultimate cult movie. Woo! I think that the less said about that, perhaps the better. But Chris tweets us, and I'm surprised the critics felt Osage County was too dramatic, but praised Lone Survivor for dramatizing war as real. Seriously?
Well,
okay, that's something to think about.
Okay.
Let's go ahead, Tom, if you'd be so kind, and let's go ahead and very quickly cover a couple other films that might fall into the so bad that they might be good category that could be future cult films. One is called The Legend of Hercules, and the other is called I, Frankenstein. Go ahead, Tom.
I can do this very quickly.
Tom.
Very quickly.
Took the bullet for us, buddy. I appreciate it.
Okay. Legend of Hercules. There's only one reason this film was made and exists, and that is the pecs and abs of Kellan Lutz. So this, in fact, does follow in the tradition of all of those Hercules movies with Steve Reeves. And so in a certain kind of sense, this is the type of film which does develop a cult following over time because it's really bad.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was a lot of fun. It was so bad that I really got a kick out of it. So quickly, the pecs and abs of Kellan Lutz, I give 5 stars.
The film,
I have to give, unfortunately, only 1.5.
Okay. And how about the pecs and abs on the display in I, Frankenstein?
That's about the only thing interesting in I, Frankenstein, too. Oh.
Yeah.
It's almost pointless to even try to tell you what the film is about.
It has something to do with Frankenstein, I guess.
Well, no, it really hardly does at all.
It's just Underworld with Frankenstein.
Yes. It's
got
flying gargoyles and sort of monsters running amok. Frankenstein monster is played by Aaron Eckhart, and he's the son. He considers himself the son of Dr. Frankenstein, and he's a really good guy. He says, "But I'm a monster." But his girlfriend says, "You're only a monster if you act like one."
Oh, dear.
Wow.
Though Aaron Eckhart, who is such a good actor, seems to want to kind of reverse of the aspirations of Mark Wahlberg and Channing Tatum, or even a Callan Hurts, who all started off as underwear models and then are striving to become actors.
Did it the other way around.
He's doing it the other way around. The most interesting thing is Aaron Eckhart's new gym-produced buff body. But skip it.
Okay, and how many stars for I, Frankenstein?
1.5.
1.5. Okay, thanks. Let's go ahead and chat a little bit about cult films. Ryan, if you'd be so kind, you probably listened to our conversation earlier where Tom was kind enough to give us a definition of cult film. What would you add to that? What, in your mind, constitutes a cult film?
Well, to me, it's really the experience of finding a film. How did you come upon American Psycho? How did you discover a film like Boondock Saints? I worry now that cult film will start to cease because of things like Netflix. Like, if I hear about Her and I hear that, you know, a small group of people liked it, I can test that out for myself instantly in a few months of its release. For things like the Rocky Horror Picture Show or even The Room, people discovered those. They were brought into it. Their friends had to tell them about it. It became a part of their life. That's why they have the cult tattoos and everything like that. So, you know, I worry about films like Dead Snow that immediately became a cult hit and then quickly just went away just because of its Netflix release. I worry that we'll lose this kind of fandom for these new cult genre films.
Well, that begs the question. You are the programmer there, so you decide what to screen and what goes into your thinking when you say, okay, this is a cult film, and this is a film we're going to showcase for the followers of that film.
Right. I think one of the biggest new cult films right now is Scott Pilgrim vs. the World. Mm-hmm. And it's a way to make it a magical again. So the way that we show it is we bring in a band. They are the new Sex Bomb. This time we're going to have kind of a flashy light show where everybody will get glow stick swords. it's a way of making those films special again. So like if I was going to show Dead Snow, I'd fill the theater with snow and zombies and kind of bring new life into a film like that.
Of course, creating that communal experience, you can't do that on the internet. You can't.
No.
Not as well as you can in a live theater. And the same way with home video, any kind of home video. I guess you could have a party, but it just doesn't seem to be quite the same effect as when you're having an experience at a theater with a lot of other like-minded people.
Right. Yeah. And that's the entire fear and the reason why Tim Leake started the Alamo Drafthouse is he does not want to lose that communal experience. There's nothing that can replace that for film. And even things that aren't cult, just that conversation to have about a movie afterward is sometimes more of an experience than the film itself.
Mm-hmm. Louisa has been waiting patiently from UMKC. She wants to make a suggestion for a cult film. Hi, Louisa. Are you there? Louisa?
Oh,
hello. There you are. You had one that you wanted to talk to us about? Hello, Louisa?
Thus far, you guys have mentioned recent movies that I would never personally go see unless they, you know, they were on Netflix, like Ryan said. And I totally agree with him that it's a lot of how you happened upon the movie.
Mm-hmm.
So one thing that I wanted to mention was the movie Scanners. And granted, this is a genre of sci-fi and horror, so that's a totally different aspect than what you guys were talking about earlier. But it seems to me the best cult movies are going to be in that horror sci-fi genre.
Interesting.
So something like Hostel or, sorry, I have a friend here too. Birdemic.
Yeah, oh my gosh. Sharknado.
Any movies that don't take a lot of brain power, that are just purely fun, and they just tap into that, like, that kidding you that, you know, it just doesn't necessarily matter what is happening in the movie. The movie itself is so entertaining that you'd watch it again and again. Sorry, that's what I had.
Okay, thanks so much, Louise. Appreciate your call. And let's go now to Joel in Leawood. Hi, Joel.
Morning, guys. You know, you were talking a second ago about how you got introduced to a movie, and I remember in high school I had finally worked up the nerve to call this girl and ask her out, and we went to a midnight movie in Denver. And we saw Rocky Horror Picture Show was a midnight show, but before that we saw a movie I'd never seen before, which has now become my favorite of all time, Harold and Maude.
Yeah.
The epitome of a cult movie. Ruth Gordon, Bud Cort's in it, obviously, but the best part is the music from Cat Stevens throughout the whole thing. It's just the most amazingly made, most beautiful movie that I, frankly, have ever seen.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite kind of sing-along movies, too. Go see that at a midnight show, and then somebody gets up with a guitar, and you just all join communally together and start chanting.
It's a great example, too, of what I had defined as sort of quality cult. Oh,
yeah.
That it's a cult film.
That's
also
not too bad to be that it's good. It's a good and it's good.
Right.
Okay, thanks so much, Joel. Appreciate your call. And let's go to Kevin in Kansas City. Hi, Kevin.
Hi there. I, in high school, saw, without knowing what I was getting into, Eraserhead. And that's, I think, the epitome of a cult film.
Are you okay?
I've seen it several times since, and I own it on DVD.
Nice.
That when I first saw it, it was on a double bill with Freaks.
Wow.
One of my favorites. Absolutely love that. I found that film on HBO and was totally taken away.
Yeah, this was really early, and it was just something that I had never even seen before. I've since followed David Lynch on all of his films, but none's quite as bizarre as Eraserhead. And I was wondering if that would ever play at the Alamo and what they would do in the event that...
Yeah. Oh, my God. It
Screaming
has.
Babies.
And we showed it in 35mm, and it was an amazing experience. I think everybody that's there, we all have matching tattoos now. It was awesome.
Hey, thanks for your call, Kevin. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right. Now let's go to Chris in Kansas City. He wants to talk about I, Frankenstein. Hi, Chris.
Hi. I listen frequently to many of my friends, and one of the issues we have with your critics, which we do enjoy and appreciate, is that oftentimes they make comparisons, like movie to I, Frankenstein, and they're really apples to oranges. If you want something existential, interpersonal, and you watch something like Her, if you need something that's escapist and mindless and just lets you let down from the day, then you watch Frankenstein. And if you compare Frankenstein within the original Frankenstein genre, hit the 4 out of 5, and that's giving a nod to the original Frankenstein, which I don't like at all. I mean, this movie had moral imperative, purpose, a greater overall theme. So what more should you want from a monster? So I think you're a little harsh, and you shouldn't be comparing apples and oranges. It really takes away some of your credibility. So, my comment. Thank you.
I'll respond to that because I think
you
make
he didn't like the original Frankenstein. Yeah. Sorry. Mm-hmm.
Tom?
I think Collier's making a really valid point. Oh, something I didn't say but I had thought about. Oh, you know, when I was kind of making fun of Legend of Hercules, Legend of Hercules accomplishes absolutely everything it sets out to do. So a case could be made that it achieves its limited goals at entertaining an audience, perhaps more than an Oscar-baiting movie like August Osage County. And I think that's an interesting sort of topic in film criticism or some serious discussion. And it kind of goes back to our talking about cult movies. Very often, of course, what's so great about them is that they do exactly what they set out to do, which is to be supremely entertaining and bring sort of joy to people.
Well, film is just
and makes
subjective.
Them feel special.
Yeah, film's subjective. So I understand when somebody, you know, they're sitting there and they're like, oh, man, I really liked I, Frankenstein, because there's been a tons of horrible movies that considered by others that I really liked. Like this year, Only God Forgives. I loved it. And I can't find – well, I found like four people. And eventually that'll grow to 10 and we'll show it at the Alamo.
There's a cult of 10.
But yeah, it's that subjective thing. I don't know if that'll happen with I, Frankenstein. But I can see – I like it when people get amped up about a movie that absolutely everybody hates.
Let's bring Shannon into the conversation, who has an entertaining alternative for us. Hi, Shannon.
Hey. Yeah, I just wanted to mention Groundhog's Day, since tomorrow's Groundhog's Day. And I think that there's this culture in America where people just, like we said earlier, it's just a very enjoyable movie, and it's just supremely entertaining. But yeah, you know, with the oncoming holiday, there's just a group of people that I think every morning, for some reason, are just fascinated with a little furry groundhog getting up and in the morning. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's just that, and that whole cast in that movie is great, I think. You know, the Bill Murray and then Harold Ramis, the Ghostbuster crew. So, yeah, I just wanted to throw it out there.
That's a great one.
Yeah, and that is, to me, just the cult of Bill Murray.
Okay, fair enough.
I love Groundhog's Day. It's a great film, but it's when you fall in love with an actor that you follow him through everything, and then you worship everything that he's ever done. I think that, you know, kind of goes along with the new films of Christian Bale.
Kay tweets us, now I'm going to have Time Warp stuck in my head all day. Thanks a lot. Well, we're here to serve. So, Kay, we understand and we appreciate it. Okay. Let's quickly, Tom, if you would, tell us about, give us an overview of the Oscar Film Showcase, because we wanted to make sure we talked about that very quickly.
Yes. One of the things which has really happened over the past several years is that the sort of putting together our programs of the Oscar-nominated shorts and animation, narrative film, and documentary have become really, really popular. Jerry Harrington has told me it's one of the most popular things that they've been doing at the Tivoli, and I understand that that's been happening across the country. I suppose that, in fact, in some ways, the pleasures of watching these series goes to something like becoming a member of a cult, in that on Oscar night, you can be among those few in the know that can actually sort of brag that you have picked your favorite. And, in fact, at the Tivoli, they let the audience vote so that they can compare their vote with what the Academy does. The animation is very diverse. I think in many ways it's kind of the most interesting of all of the series, but that may depend upon your taste of just really loving animation. There's a beautiful Japanese animated film called Possessions. And there's one of my favorites is Room on the Broom. There's some very good narrative ones and then documentary. I don't think I'll try to review them. I'll let you go see them judge yourself.
Okay, sounds good. Greg emails us to say that Monty Python and the Holy Grail just has so many great lines. I could watch it over and over again. And R from Midtown writes, I recently watched Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai.
Oh, yeah.
The movie seems designed to be a cult movie, yet I believe it still became one, and due to the extensive universe it created. I completely agree.
Oh, yeah.
Lori, let's quickly talk about the film that opens today. It's called That Awkward Moment.
I seem to be the only person among the critics who actually found this generally pretty funny. mostly because you've got three young guys played by Zac Efron, Michael B. Jordan, and Miles Teller. And, you know, they're just single guys hanging around New York City. And it's basically just the interaction between them and the women that they fall for. You know, it's obviously it's very predictable. It goes off in kind of stupid directions occasionally. But when you get the three guys together and they're just improvising and have this interplay going on, I actually found it pretty funny. I think they have a good chemistry, and that made it at least amusing enough for me to give it a 3.
Ouch. Well, I didn't have the same reaction you did. I found it just very tired. And, you know, it was like a cliched TV sitcom, but with dirty sex talk so that they could try to appeal to a demographic that finds that kind of thing amusing. And I think that's
it's
small
a fair
group.
Criticism.
I think so, too. I'm going to give it a 2. So we'll even that out to a 2.5.
Sure.
Okay, 2.5 for that awkward moment, which is really when you realize you've plunked down $5 or whatever to see the movie. I hope I'm pronouncing this right. Benna Kulzar writes us in an email, "My all-time favorite cult movie is Since Ofar Left. It's a very poetic movie that nobody seems to see anymore. Have you heard of it? Has anyone heard of it?"
I've heard of it. I don't know that much about it, but I've heard the title.
Yeah, I've never seen it. It's on my list now.
And let's quickly get Rick into the conversation because Rick wants to talk about The Big Lebowski. Hi, Rick.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I didn't know if anybody mentioned it yet, but that's a cult film for me. It's one I can see over and over again. And the last time I went to see it up at one of the small theaters up North Greenland theaters, everybody in the audience was kind of looked like they could have been characters in the movie, but they weren't really dressed in costumes. It just looked like that's the way they dressed every day.
Terrific.
Plus everybody's drinking White Russians, so
you bet.
That was the drink of choice to carry to drink in the theaters. I could see that movie, you know, once every couple of months, because even though you know what's coming, you still laugh or cheer or whatever.
Yeah, that's definitely a movie that's become a part of my everyday life. We showed it every Monday when we opened, and that is one of the best cult movies to ever exist. And it almost changes, you know, into fetish cinema rather than cult, just people wanting to be the dude.
Tell us quickly about the most exciting event you've got coming up that you have planned for the Alamo Drafthouse.
Oh, my gosh. I'm really excited. This Saturday we're showing American Psycho. My raincoat came in today, and I'm always stocked up on fake blood.
Uh-huh.
And, I'm really excited about that. We'll cover the floor in newspaper, and it'll be a good time.
With Christian Bale as a psychotic killer.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Can I give a shout out to my favorite personal cult movie?
Go ahead.
Repo Man.
Yes.
Yes, definitely.
So good.
Thanks to my fellow movie critics, Tom Poe and Lori Lockerbie, and special guest Ryan Davis, the creative manager at the Alamo Drafthouse. Central Standard returns on Monday with a review of the Super Bowl ads and what they can tell us about ourselves. Stick around for Up to Date with singer-songwriter Greg Brown. Our show today was produced by Matthew Long Biddleton and Ross Steinmetz. Our announcer is Linda Scher. I'm Russ Simmons. This is Central Standard on KCUR. Enjoy your weekend.